All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've got another packed show for you today, a really exciting show. So let's get into it. At the back end of the show, we'll be hearing an interview with playwright Tom Jacobson, the writer of the play Walking to Buchenwald. Now, this play is called A Comedy with Shattering Consequences, and it contains a challenge to all of us living in the U.S. right now. And before that, we'll be speaking with Jerry Lemke. Jerry Lemke is Associate Professor Emeritus at College of the Holy Cross. He is the author of The Spitting Image, Myth and Memory and the Legacy of Vietnam, and Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. He's going to be talking with us about the new documentary series by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick on the Vietnam War. And right now, I'm pleased to welcome back to the show Dr. Michael Mann, a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State and the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. He joins us to talk about the role of climate change in extreme weather events like Hurricane Harvey and all of the others. If you've been paying attention to what's going on in the world right now, and in particular with the future of the world and as well as the present, the threat from just massive, you know, that's the result of massive abuse of the climate over who knows how long. I mean, you're talking about generations and generations. But particularly what's been developing most recently, all kinds of extreme weather is sweeping across the U.S. and other parts of the world. And we are, you know, people are suffering, people are dying. And the most enraging thing is that it doesn't have to be this way. But it is, and it is because of a lot of the things that are being done by the people that are ruling over the world. Joining us to talk about all this today is Michael Mann. Michael is a professor of atmospheric science and director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He co-authored with the Washington Post cartoonist Tom Tolles, The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be with you.
Yeah, it's always good to talk with you, man. Let's start off with the big question. Where do things stand now? How bad is it?
Well, I mean, as I often said recently, the impacts of climate change are no longer subtle. We are seeing them play out in real time. Here on the East Coast, of course, we have seen two unprecedented storms, Harvey, which was the most flood-producing hurricane on record here in the United States, and, of course, Irma, which devastated the Caribbean islands, Key West, Florida, led to massive flooding along the Florida coast. It was the strongest storm, as measured by peak wind speeds, ever in the open Atlantic. So let's take stock. Over the last 2 years or so, when global sea surface temperatures have been at an all-time high, the warmest on record, we have seen the strongest hurricane globally, Patricia in the Pacific a couple years ago. We have seen the strongest hurricane in both the northern and southern hemisphere. In the southern hemisphere, we had Winston, which struck Fiji, the strongest hurricane ever observed in the southern hemisphere, strongest hurricane ever in the Pacific, and now with Irma, the strongest hurricane ever in the open Atlantic. Long ago, we said that as we continue to warm surface temperatures, this is one of the easiest things to predict because it's basically just the laws of thermodynamics. And they tell us that as you warm the ocean surface, you're going to get stronger storms, stronger hurricanes. The strongest hurricanes will get stronger. And you will see more flooding because there's more moisture in the air when the air is warmer. And we saw that. That was part of what contributed to the record flooding in Harvey. So we long predicted that this would be the case, and now we're seeing it. And as we here on the East Coast are dealing with these devastating storms, and there's another one brewing, as your listeners may know, Maria, who is now about to strike several of the Leeward Islands, the same islands that suffered through Irma, are now going to get hit again by a hurricane that is intensifying very quickly, and the warmer those ocean temperatures, the faster these storms intensify, and we're seeing it once again. While all of this is happening here in the east, of course, you folks out west have been suffering through record heat and a record wildfire season. Let me say it again, the impacts of climate change are no longer subtle. We're now seeing them. They are making extreme events even more extreme, and whether we're talking about hurricanes or droughts or floods or wildfires, we're now seeing this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, you once said that climate change has literally changed the fabric within which all weather now occurs.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, the atmosphere on average, the surface of the Earth, in the lower atmosphere, is more than a degree Fahrenheit warmer than it was a century ago. In fact, roughly a degree Celsius, almost a degree and a half Fahrenheit warmer than it was. And that means, again, basic thermodynamics tells us that that means there's probably somewhere between 5, 6, 7% more moisture in the atmosphere. And that means that there is more moisture available to be turned into record precipitation, whether it's rainfall, flooding rains in these hurricanes, and the many thousand-year rainfall events we've seen around the country over the last couple years, events that shouldn't happen on their own, you know, due to chance alone, more often than once in a thousand years, and we're seeing lots of these events because we're literally loading the dice, the random dice of weather, towards more of these events. It's very basic physics. It's basic thermodynamics that tells us that a warmer atmosphere has more moisture. That means you get more floods, and there's more energy in the atmosphere to intensify tropical storms or to give us these record nor'easters we've seen on the East Coast. Counterintuitively, it's seemingly paradoxical, but it's not, is the fact that warmer winters, where it's still cold enough to snow, and on the east coast of the U.S., in Washington, D.C., through New England, it's still going to be cold enough to snow in the winter. And because the winters are warmer, that means there's actually more moisture in the atmosphere. That moisture can feed these massive storms known as nor'easters that form along the northeast coast and themselves have very damaging winds associated with them, but they produce record amounts of snowfall. And so, yes, record snowfalls doesn't disprove climate change. It's actually consistent with what we expect. We expect a shorter season where the ground is covered with snow, but individual snowfall events, we expect them to become more intense. And these nor'easters, like these hurricanes, we expect them to become more intense because there's more warmth, there's more moisture in the atmosphere, and that moisture is what provides the energy to intensify those storms.
So is that the whole story about why these storms today seem to grow much bigger and much stronger than people have ever seen?
Yeah, it's actually not rocket science. More warmer temperatures, more moisture in the atmosphere means more fuel for strengthening these storms. And we're seeing it. In fact, we have estimated, there was an article that appeared in Nature a few years ago that estimated from observations, this isn't theoretical, this is actually from the observations, we can see an increase in about 10 miles per hour in the peak wind speeds of the strongest hurricanes with each degree Fahrenheit of warming. That amounts to roughly a 7% increase in wind speeds. That might not sound so bad, but guess what? The destructive potential of a hurricane is proportional to the third power of the wind. So that 7% increase in wind speeds means a roughly 20% increase in destructive potential. That's not subtle. That sort of increase, you can see it happening, and we are seeing it happening.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also said that almost all of the strongest hurricanes on record have occurred over the past 2 years. What is it about the past 2 years that actually seems to have concentrated a lot of this?
We've seen record global temperatures for the past few years. There was a period of time during which the contrarians, the climate change deniers, made a lot of hay out of this supposed hiatus or pause. There wasn't a pause in global warming, but we had a sustained period of La Nina, El Niños and La Niñas. These are natural climate events that impact weather around the world. El Niño year tends to be warmer than average. A La Niña year tends to be colder than average. And we had a number of La Niña years in a row. We sort of had a decade-long period where we were in La Niña conditions much of the time. And that actually combined with some small natural factors of volcanic activity, small variations in the output of the sun, all these natural factors sort of conspired to offset some of global warming over the period of, you know, the better part of a decade. But those natural factors swing one direction at one time, and then they swing in the other direction at the other time. And they're temporary. It was a temporary reprieve from the ongoing warming of the climate. And now that those natural factors have subsided, we're now seeing that we're still, as we always were, very much on this course of a rate of warming right now that is about 2 degrees Celsius. So that's, you know, more than 3 degrees Fahrenheit warming per century. That is the trajectory that we are on right now.
Mm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Michael Mann. Michael's a professor of atmospheric science and the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. And we're talking about what the hell is going on in relation to the climate, in relation to climate change, in relation to all the, everybody knows it, everybody sees it, all the just devastating things that have been happening in relation to the climate all over the world. Now, Michael, tell me this. I was trying to figure this out. Like, actually, how do we look at, well, let's look at the sea level rise, because that's not something that, I mean, I remember when I was a kid, you know, we'd go down to the Atlantic coast or somewhere and we'd, you know, it was fun. Sometimes there'd be a storm. There'd be like, you know, the water would be really much deeper towards the shore and all this stuff. But it was just, it was there and it was happening. It's very different today when you're talking about sea level rise and how that contributes to actually how it's threatening human society and the planet, frankly.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, and that's another one of those factors where people can debate the details of the various processes involved in the intensification of these tropical storms and in which of those processes might have been impacted by climate change. But here's something that we can't debate. The fact that global sea level has risen, you know, more than half a foot over the past century in some areas, like New York City, it's close to a foot. We've seen the veritable tip of the iceberg. We're starting to see global sea levels bend upward, and we know there's a lot more to come as we start to melt the major ice sheets, which are going to be the major contributors to ongoing sea level rise. So regardless of what else might have been impacted by climate change, Sandy, Superstorm Sandy, 1 foot of that 13-foot storm surge was due to global sea level rise. That added a foot to the size of that storm surge that struck Battery Park, New York, that struck the Jersey coastline. I grew up going to the Jersey coast with my grandparents, and that, what might sound like a small amount of sea level rise, 1 foot, actually meant 25 more square miles of coastal flooding and billions of dollars of additional damage that was done. And that's just 1 foot. Now, if we continue on the course that we're on, the science is now fairly clear about this. By the end of this century, we're probably talking about 6 feet, 6 feet of global sea level rise, at least. If we continue with, again, business as usual, we don't abate ongoing burning of fossil fuels, then, you know, you can see what 1 foot has already done. We're seeing the inundation of low-lying island nations. Bangladesh has suffered through record flooding. It's impacted both by sea level rise and potentially more rainfall that now comes with the monsoons because that atmosphere is warmer and holds more moisture. And, of course, with Sandy, with Harvey, now the Gulf Coast, sea level rise in that region, climate change-related sea level rise has been a little less. It's been about a half a foot. But that means that there was that storm surge associated with Harvey was at least a half a foot higher than it otherwise would have been, and that led, once again, to a lot more flooding. Now, if we truly stay on the course we're on and we have, you know, 6 feet plus of sea level rise by the end of the century, then we're starting to talk about literally retreating from the major coastal cities of the world. It would be a massive upheaval. You can imagine the conflict that would come as we have to locate 25% of the world's population over a time scale of just decades. So, yeah, in a worst-case scenario, we're talking about calamitous changes, calamitous impacts. The good news is that we still have time to choose a different path.
Mm-hmm. Tell me this, we're going back on this a little bit, the fact that we've been talking about the storms today are growing, have grown much bigger and much stronger. At the same time, you know, when you're talking about all this, you've made the point that global warming, and I like this phrase, global warming is juicing storms, and the effect of global warming has on extreme events. It makes Irma and Harvey even more dangerous and more likely than it would have ever been in other times.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, warmer temperatures means more energy to strengthen these storms. Warmer temperatures in the summer when you don't have rainfall and in regions, in subtropical regions and mid-latitude regions that see relatively little rainfall and where you tend to have sinking dry air in the summer, well, those warmer temperatures evaporate what moisture you do have in the soil even faster, and you get worsened drought. And California suffered through what we have reason to believe now was their worst drought in at least 1,200 years. Tree ring specialists have extended the record back in time. They can only go back 1,200 years, but they say that that drought was the worst in 1,200 years. So it's making the droughts worse. And you have more heat extremes, more drought, drier soils. That comes together, and you get the sort of record wildfires that we're seeing this season. This is the worst fire season out west on record. It's not a mystery why. It's getting drier, and it's getting hotter. And the forests are weakened, ironically, by pests like pine bark beetles that can live through the increasingly warm winters. And so the forests have been weakened by these pests that in part have prospered as winters have warmed up, and that creates much more fuel for these fires when they do happen in the summer.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the situation where Harvey actually was stalled over Texas with 50 inches of rain causing all kinds of disastrous flooding?
Yeah, so that's an important thing to understand about Harvey. A substantial part of why we saw that record flooding, more than 4 feet in some parts of Houston, was because of the stalled nature of that weather system. It just stayed in place. And when weather systems stay in place, that's when you start to get extremes. You get extreme droughts. When the same location is being baked by the sun day after day, you get extreme heat waves under those circumstances. You get extreme flooding when storms stay parked over the same place day after day. And this is where, you know, the connections become a little bit more tenuous. There is an emerging body of research, and we've published on this ourselves, that suggests that as we warm the planet, and in particular, the Arctic warms even faster, because as the ice melts, the Earth's surface, you know, the Arctic Ocean can absorb more of the incoming sunlight when there isn't ice on top of it, and so it warms even faster. And this, in part, leads to what's known as Arctic amplification, where warming is even greater as you go north towards the Arctic. And as you change that pattern of how temperatures vary from the tropics to the polar regions, it turns out that that pattern of variation is actually what controls the jet stream. The jet stream owes its existence to changes in temperature with latitude and changes in temperature with height in the atmosphere. And so as you start to change those temperature patterns, you can change the jet stream. And as you weaken the contrast between the equator and pole, which is what happens when you warm the poles a lot more than the tropics, you decrease the contrast. You decrease the difference in temperature between the warm tropics and the cold polar region. And as you reduce that contrast, that tends to weaken the jet stream. What's also true is that climate change tends to shift the jet stream poleward. So, for example, with Harvey, we had this very large blocking high pressure, this ridge over the southern United States. The jet stream had been pushed way up to the north. That is consistent with what climate model projections say, that we're going to tend to see the jet stream in the summer pushed further north. And there weren't these troughs associated with the jet stream there to come through and sort of take Harvey away and take it out, take it east toward the Atlantic Ocean. So, you know, we can't say with certainty that those mechanisms were responsible for the specific behavior of Harvey, but we can say that climate change is creating conditions in terms of the behavior of the jet stream and the weakened nature of the jet stream and the poleward migration of the jet stream is favoring the sorts of conditions that we saw with Harvey, where these systems can stay stalled. We saw that with Irene back in 2011, was a devastating hurricane that produced record flooding in Pennsylvania and up through New England. It was only a hurricane when it struck the New Jersey coast, but sea surface temperatures off the coast, off the East Coast, were very high, unusually high at that time. That meant there was more moisture in the air, and there was more moisture to turn into record flooding. So we see this theme repeating itself over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Now, one last question here. We can say that none of this is coincidence. And once and for all, I'd like you to actually speak to this. What is the role of human-induced climate change in all these events that we've been talking about, the things that you've been saying? It's not sort of just they happen spontaneously. There is a role of humanity in all this in terms of both it happening and in terms of the worsening of it all.
Yeah, absolutely. There are certain things that are ironclad. We don't even have to talk about them probabilistically, statistically. We can just say sea level rise means that these storm surges are bigger. Full stop. That's a very direct causal connection. More moisture in the atmosphere, greater intensity because of warmer sea surface temperatures, those are statistical relationships. On average, we expect storms to be stronger and for there to be more moisture because ocean temperatures are warmer. In any one case, of course, the vagaries of weather come into play. And, you know, just how any one weather event evolves depends on a number of factors, some of which are random. But a way to think about this, once again, is like dice. And we're loading the dice so that these sixes are coming up much more often than they should. And, you know, those sixes can take the form of unprecedented superstorms, unprecedented droughts, floods, heat waves. These things are happening significantly more often than we would expect in the absence of our warming of the planet and a change in climate that we are causing. And, you know, in the same sense that the tobacco industry was found guilty of hiding health impacts of their product was killing people. And we can't prove that any one person who smoked cigarettes for 20 years and died of lung cancer, we can't prove that they wouldn't have died of lung cancer anyways. That's possible, but we can step back and look at the fact that 10 times as many people died as should have, that smoking cigarettes increased the likelihood of you getting lung cancer by a factor of more than 10. We say that smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer. We're comfortable saying that, even though it's a statistical linkage. We should be equally comfortable in saying that warming the planet with greenhouse gases leads to more destructive storms, worse droughts, worse floods, and that's exactly what we're seeing.
All right, Michael Mann, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Sure. That was Michael Mann. And as we said, Michael Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State and the director of Penn State Earth System Science Center. And he joined us to talk about the role of climate change in extreme weather events like all the hurricanes that we've just been having. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Jerry Lemke, so stay tuned. Joining us now, if you've been paying any attention at all to what's going on in the TV world, you would have noticed that Ken Burns has a brand new, it's at least a 10-part series, and it's a huge thing on the Vietnam War, and he's really going all out with this one. But it's all out actually in a very bad direction overall, I think. And it's an estimation of the Vietnam War that I think needs to be really dug into and basically summed up. And joining us now to talk about all this is just the person that can do this. His name is Jerry Lemke. He's been on the show a number of times before. He's an associate professor emeritus at the College of the Holy Cross. He is the author of Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, and Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and the Fantasies of Betrayal, as well as a number of other books. And he's here to talk with us about this new documentary series from Ken Burns. All right, Jerry, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be with you again.
You too, man. Let's jump into this. Your overall assessment of the film series, all right? It's really important because,
that's too big. Too big a question to start with. I mean, first of all, as you said, it is huge. It's 18 hours of watching, and I've watched it all once and a good part of it twice. And, you know, it can actually kind of wear you down after a while. One of my criticisms of it that didn't get into, I have written about it and it's posted online, but one of the criticisms that didn't get in is that it tends to be battle after battle after battle after battle, you know, with a lot of the conflicts not put in any kind of historical or political context. And so the first time I watched, going through at about episode 3, you know, which was already 5 or 6 hours into it, I began to have that question on my mind, what is this all about? I'm getting a bunch of pieces here, but what's the whole of which these pieces are pieces of? What does it all add up to? In the end, what I come out of it with, what it's really about is It's really, it comes down to a coming home story of what happened to Vietnam veterans when they returned from the war and the supposed hostility that they met with. And my criticism of that narrative has been for a number of years is that it feeds into the fiction that the war was lost at home, that it was lost to weak-kneed liberals in Congress and to radicals in the streets who greeted the veterans with hostility. And that feeds a very, very dangerous storyline that we could have won that war if the American people had stuck behind the military mission, and we could win wars like it again if the American people just stick with the military mission. And I think that that is a dangerous storyline, and I think, and maybe we could go into it, but I know in other programs that you've done, we see that playing out today, I think, a lot in our politics concerning the wars that we're involved in now.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I wanted to talk with you about, too, though, is that, look, this is, and you point this out, this is one of the biggest TV events in relation to the Vietnam War that there's been since the Vietnam War.
That's right.
And it's very heavy because it's putting out a certain poll in the world right now. And there's the claim by the filmmakers in a May 29th New York Times op-ed that you pointed out, which is that the film really is not about correcting, you know, all the bad stuff that came out of Vietnam or anything like that, but it talks about that the film is about healing. And you argue that this is really misleading, and I think it's extremely important that people understand
sure.
that, because that's what comes across. It's about healing. Let's all get together and heal.
Exactly. Well, see, that sets up a kind of myth that America, the United States, was a unified, happy country before the war in Vietnam. And the war ripped that fabric. The war tore the country apart, and so that it needs to be healed. And if you accept that rhetoric of healing, then you kind of unconsciously buy into the storyline that the country was a kind of onesie politically and culturally before the war. And the country wasn't. The country actually by the late 1950s, was quite divided by racial conflict. It was very divided by issues of communism and anti-communism, which, of course, we have to go into in talking about the war. But the United States came out of World War II very concerned about the way the Soviet Union had, very positively acquitted itself in the war. My historians say the war was won by the Soviets on the Eastern Front, and the Communist parties in Europe played a very positive role in fighting fascism during the war. And then, of course, after the war, the Chinese Communist Party, the success of the Chinese Revolution raised great anxiety among the American ruling class about where the rest of the world is going after World War II. And domestically, there are, similar storylines that were very troubling for the powers that be in the country. The U.S. political left had played a very positive role in the CIO labor movements of the 1930s. There were communists who went to Europe as part of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in Spain to fight fascists there, even before the U.S. got into the war itself. And then in the 1950s, civil rights activity began to pick up movements for civil rights. People like Paul Robeson, for example, a singer, actor, All-American football player, who was a very powerful figure in the civil rights movement, was also closely associated with the communist left. So there was a lot going on in the 1950s already that were, even prior to it, if you go back to the labor movement of the 1930s, that kind of give the lie to this idea that of a unified, happy-go-lucky America of the 1950s, that the war and the anti-war movement were responsible for tearing apart.
Yeah, exactly. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking today with Jerry Lemke, Associate Professor Emeritus at College of the Holy Cross. He is the author of Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, and Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal, among many other books as well. And we're talking about the new documentary series by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick on the Vietnam War. Now, tell me this, Jerry. You know, one of the things that you argue, too, and I thought this was really important, that no historians or experts appear in the film. Instead,
yeah,
there's this sort of ground-up, we're on the ground view of the war from 79 mostly ordinary people who lived through it, which kind of jettisons the whole idea of the search for truth in exchange for what's the popular opinion?
Well, it jettisons the idea of this as a documentary. I mean, my goodness, historians are the people who find the documents and who interpret the documents. And the filmmakers seem to pride themselves as having shunned the participation of, as they say, talking head experts, I think is their words. And I do think they also use historians in one of their interviews. But they certainly don't shun experts. They don't. They very selectively use experts. And one that I single out is John Negroponte, who kind of cut his teeth in the diplomatic corps as a young State Department Foreign Service officer in Vietnam. And then since that time, my goodness, this man has been involved in many of the coup d'etats that the U.S. has been involved in all over the world, what we now refer to nicely as regime change operations. John Negroponte has been central to them. In fact, you could almost predict where the next coup was going to happen when you saw that John Negroponte was assigned to this new diplomatic post. Well, he's in the film at a couple of places. Leslie Kelb, who was very involved in government circles during the war, is in the film in several places. So it's not as though they shunned these voices at all. They very selectively chose who they were and chose people who don't make any pretense, really, of being independent, as scholars might be or as historians might be.
What about how the film portrays the anti-war movement, GI resistors, all of this, the whole movement? Let's talk about that a little.
Well, that's, of course, a lot of your listeners are undoubtedly very keen on that and want to know that. And we've already gotten, I should say, I saw the entire film before it began to air. Others of your listeners may have seen now, I think, the first five episodes. So we see a little bit of how the anti-war movement is being portrayed. And here I think the key thing is what I call in the piece that I wrote is false balancing. Is what we get is one piece that makes the anti-war movement look good, right? Makes it look credible, makes it look sincere, and then sometimes quickly followed by something else that erases that positive image. And here's an example of that. One of the people that it uses is a fellow who was an ROTC graduate of the University of Nebraska, who then went into the military but decided he didn't want to stay in the military, and he went then to Canada. He deserted and went to Canada. Now, the film treats that, you know, pretty nicely, pretty even-handedly. And then immediately following that, the very next words are, and 30,000 Canadians volunteered to go to Vietnam. And I look and I said, what? You know, what does that, the latter sentence there, what does that have to do with the fact that this fellow went to Canada? And I say, absolutely nothing other than a kind of balancing, right? A kind of, yeah, but, or a kind of, but we should know that, right? There's another that was last night, I think in last night's episode that people would have seen. We get the 1967 march on the Pentagon, and then that is immediately, that's dealt with pretty well, pretty nicely, pretty okay. But then it's immediately followed by this vignette about an American Indian, a Kiowa Indian, who was highly decorated in World War II and in Korea, and then is killed in Vietnam. So we have his mother talking about his loyalty and how much it meant to him to go to war for his country. Now, I say a vignette because it's just kind of stuck in there. Mm-hmm. And I say, for what other purpose than to contrast, right, the people who are protesting the war with this noble American Indian, right, who has gone off to fight. But, Michael, that's not all, right? After we get the Kiowa Indian piece, then it goes directly to hippies yeah, dancing very wildly, very hedonistically looking, dancing to, I think, a Mama's and Papa's tune with no explanation. And then it goes to a Vietnam veteran saying that he didn't know anything about hippies until he got to Vietnam and then heard about hippies, and he hated hippies. So we're kind of whipsawed there.
Right. Now, Jerry, we're running up on time, and there's something, a really important point I wanted you to speak to.
Sure.
You show in the film, or you show in your article, you talk about this one woman who was a former anti-war activist during Vietnam,
yes,
and who repents for calling veterans baby killers. And
right,
you speak to that in a way that not only goes after the lie there, but also you also point out the very dangerous objective impact of that now and in the future, back then and in the future. But we only have about 2.5 minutes to do this, okay?
Well, you know, you say not just to the lie of it, because so many people get hung up on the empirical stuff on this. You know, they'll say to me, didn't that really happen? And that's really not the point. The point is, I think what you're trying to suggest is how that plays out in American political culture today. The myth that anti-war activists spat on Vietnam veterans, the myth that anti-war activists called Vietnam veterans baby killers, of course, discredit the anti-war movement. They say to young people, look, you don't want to be like those people in the 1960s who did these kind of things, so you don't want to come out in resistance to the war. And it also feeds this idea that we lost the war because of betrayal at home. It's the betrayal narrative for the loss of the war. And it's that same kind of narrative that ate at Germany after World War I that led Germany to rearm, and not only to rearm and have another go, right, at war, but then to turn inward and scapegoat, right, to look for and to go after those people, those organizations, those idea sets that are held responsible for the loss of the war. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think, you know, the story like spitting on veterans or that whole victim veteran, I think, mythology is part of that. And it kind of washes out the idea that so many veterans came home
right
and joined the anti-war movement.
Right. On that note, Jerry, we're going to have to wrap it up. I really wish you had more time. I got stuck on the freeway. Actually, that was a problem. Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll have you back, man. Definitely. All right. Definitely.
Okay,
all right, Jerry Lemke.
With you.
Thank you very
Bye-bye.
Much. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've just been talking with Jerry Lemke, Associate Professor Emeritus at College of the Holy Cross. He's the author of Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, and Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Tom Jacobson, the author of the play Walking to Buchenwald. So stay tuned.
Ein, zwei, drei, vier.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany just before the war. A meanness.
I recently saw a play that just, I'll tell you, it just blew my mind. I went in thinking, okay, it's going to be something I know. There's probably going to be a heavy element to it because the name of it was Walking to Buchenwald. And how could you have a play that was going to be nothing but laughs if it's about Buchenwald or walking to Buchenwald? But I sat down and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And as I'm watching it, it just, things began to develop. They just began to come up out of the floor, out of the sky. They were just coming together, and there was a certain direction things were going in that I don't think I really fully expected after the first part of the play. But then as it developed, I was just blown away. And I'm talking to Tom Jacobson, the playwright, right now. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Tom, first off, as I was telling you earlier, this play is something that just sort of, I was just blown away by it when I saw it. And in the week that's since seeing it, I have just continued to think about it and talk about it. And it was just one of the most remarkable ones that I've seen in quite a while. So I want you to tell people what the play is about.
In 2002, my partner and I took my parents to Europe for the first and only time that they went to Europe. And it was a wonderful experience in many ways, but it was also that parent-child experience. And it was happening at the same time the U.S. was gearing up to invade Iraq. So we heard from Europeans while we were on this trip. We went to England and France on that trip. So mostly we heard from the English, their opinions of the United States and of our president at that time. And it was very illuminating. My parents lived at the time in Oklahoma. They joke that they're the only Democrats in the entire state. That's not quite true, but almost. So they were very happy to talk about their discontent when they were on this trip. And I found it very moving to hear from other people, to hear my parents' reactions, to watch our family dynamic, and to sort of chart the politics of that. So I took that experience and I added it to an experience we'd had a couple of years earlier when my partner and I went to Germany and we visited Weimar and wanted to visit Buchenwald, to go to the concentration camp. We got on the wrong bus and we ended up having to get off the bus and literally walk to Buchenwald through the woods. And we made some discoveries along the way that were not on the map. And it felt pretty powerful to me. So I put those two trips together along with the anxiety we were feeling by the time I actually wrote the play, which was in 2003 and the invasion had already occurred. And I wrote it at the time to be evergreen. So it wasn't specifically about Iraq. It was not specifically about Bush. It was about an American president making some decisions that the people in the play did not agree with. And it never got produced. When Obama became president, there was even less interest in the play. And about a month before the last election, the Open Fist Theater Company said, let's do a couple of readings of this play as a fundraiser before the play becomes irrelevant after Hillary is elected. They did this fundraiser. The producer's daughter ran out of the theater in tears at the end. And we sort of thought, well, that was good. I'm glad we did that. And then the election happened and Open Fist came back to me and said, now we have to do a full production of this play.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing when you say that, because there's like, on one level, there's like, you know, you're talking that many more than a decade ago and you're, what's changed, you know, and you can say, look at it and say, well, actually, there's another thing going on here where the world is actually shaping up like that. But it has changed dramatically in terms of the actual gravity of the situation and how much, you know, it's built even more than it was under Bush. And what the world we're living in today is a very dangerous place. And when I was thinking about that, it's sort of like as the play goes along, there's actually, even though, and again, I'm going to warn people, I'm not going to tell you anything that's going to give you a hint about what happens in the play. But as you go along, things get more and more foreboding. And it kind of really caught me on my seat because it grows bigger. Everything grows bigger. The sense of foreboding grows bigger. And you're looking at it and you've described, you know, and then I'm looking at this and then I look at what you've described the play as a shattering comedy. And I was like, what? And then I thought, yeah, actually, it sort of is. But what did you mean by that?
Well, there's a lot of humor in the play, and that's sort of how I usually lure the audience in. I find that audiences are more sympathetic to characters when the characters make them laugh. And it's a seduction. If the audience is like, oh, I like these people, they make me laugh, I'm going to follow this journey. And then as the play progresses, it gets more and more serious and more dire on both a personal level, the lives of these four main characters, and then on a national and international level politically. And those that ratcheting up of the tension progresses on both levels in parallel throughout the play.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because I read one description of it that said it's sort of it's about what it means to be an American in a world that no longer admires the U.S. And I wanted to know what you thought about that.
Well, that's kind of how I thought about it from the very beginning. It's sometimes hard to remember how we felt 14 years ago, but that's one advantage of having written a play that long ago is I put down what I was thinking and feeling at that point. And the play literally at that time was about going to other countries and hearing what people thought of us, and it wasn't admiration. In fact, one of the things they said to us in France was, "We don't hate Americans. We only hate one America." That's not in the play. But it was a really fascinating exploration, you know, in life. And so that's one of the reasons that I wanted to put it into the play.
You know, one thing that happens, too, though, in the play is that while you have this, you know, you have that, you have the comic dialogue, you have all that, which is actually really funny. And it's really, it sort of brings you, you know, you're sitting there and you're watching it, and it brings you into this family of people that are on the stage. And you're sort of sitting there and you just like being there. You like listening to them. You like seeing what they're doing. But it's also, you're doing this, and eventually the play is going along, and it becomes a lot of talk about circumstances that people live in and about life and death issues. And you're kind of going there, and it's that life and death, no matter what, is always presented. It runs through the play, and it's in small but eventually very huge ways. And I thought that was like, I didn't see it coming that way. You know, I really didn't. I was sort of, and I was paying attention. I'm watching. I'm thinking, okay, when is this going to get to the Buchenwald part? You know, I didn't see it. I was listening very carefully to what people were saying, and I was getting a little kind of like, wow, these conversations are getting very deep and very worrisome in terms of the part of the people and the kind of atmosphere that they were setting. Why that?
Well, the play is literally a walk. It proceeds at a slow pace of revelation. And as we talked about in a comic way at the beginning, and it's sneaky. It does sneak up on you. And Buchenwald as a metaphor functions in many, many ways in the play. But death is present throughout the play. Buchenwald's a symbol of death. It's a symbol of totalitarianism, of oppressive government, of things going horribly wrong. At the same time, the play introduces the concept of museums very early and the things that go into museums. And there's a moral question that one of the characters explores. They all do, but the father in particular says, well, is it right to go to museums about tragedies? Is that some way entertaining yourself with a tragic event like the 9/11 museum, which wasn't around at the time I wrote the play, or the Oklahoma City bombing memorial? And the characters are from Oklahoma City. My parents lived there and they felt the bombing. That's described in the play, and the memorial is described in the play. And I've been to that memorial a few times, and there's a profound feeling. But I wanted to examine that feeling and the experience of what you do in a museum or you do at a memorial and the moral implications of that. Now, I don't know where the play actually comes down. The mother says it's important to go, it's important to learn, it's important to pay respects. That's all articulated. But the father sort of establishes this as a question. I work in a museum at the Natural History Museum here in LA. And so I think about the concept of museums a lot. And what's important about them is there's a bunch of stuff in there, and you can study that stuff now with the tools you have. You can study it in 100 years with the tools that we will have in 100 years. For instance, at the Natural History Museum, we can study DNA now. Well, you couldn't do that when we collected our bird specimens 100 years ago, but we still have the birds and we can still study their DNA. There are dead things in the play from the very beginning. There are taxidermy animals that they visit at a creepy museum in Cornwall that it no longer exists. They took pets and taxidermied them and put them in situations that are not truly pet-like.
Just give people one sense of that, just one sense of it, because I've seen it printed before, so it won't ruin anything.
Right. There are guinea pigs playing cricket. and kittens serving tea. And in the diorama with the kittens serving tea, they were all white kittens of exactly the same age. And there was a sign on them that said these kittens were not killed for this display. Well, I'm not sure I believe that. That museum has since been taken down and its collections disseminated. I don't know how.
I'm going to find it.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking with playwright Tom Jacobson, the author of the play Walking to Buchenwald. Here's the thing. You make a point. I'm trying to remember where I read this, but you've said this thing, but theater is a mutable thing, and that's what makes it living and unique. And the father in a play said something about theater and the role of theater that was really important, I think, in terms of, I don't think I've ever heard it described that way, in terms of describing theater as its role in society and its role in relation to people. And I thought that was a really very heavy thing to bring out, because it also, it served as sort of another thing that then, when you planted that pole, then everything that was unfolding in the play began to sort of come off of that and around that.
Well, the father says many things about theater because he is a theater professor and he thinks about theater. And he's retired, so he has time to think. He talks about the mutability of theater, how theater is different from all other narrative arts because it changes. One of the things that changed in this play from the time it was written 14 years ago to the present is the audience is different. If the play had been done then, it wouldn't be the same as it is now. The audience has 14 years of experience. They've experienced three different presidents during the time since I first wrote the play, and they bring those three presidents with them into the theater. They would have brought just one of those presidents in if it had been produced in 2003.
That would have been enough.
Well, that was enough then for the play to make sense and to for us to have a passionate reaction to it, because we felt very passionate about the situation then. The situation is different now. It is, to my mind, worse now. I wrote a play that I intended to be evergreen and about a president making bad decisions. So that has worked out. And the play's time, I guess, has finally come.
One thing with the mother character, okay, with her, one of the things that she does understand, and I think it's important, she understands that there's much more, you know, because, look, there's a lot of things when they go there, and at first it's like, oh, these people aren't going to appreciate us. There's that feeling of, we want to be friendly with the people who live in the countries that we're going to, but then there's also, they get rebuffed at times, and they develop a little bit of a shell and sort of a little, you know, well, these people are just whatever, you know. There's a scene in France that I think actually was the first hint for a lot of people that there was something else developing parallel to what's going on with this trip. It really got to me because there's also a situation where she was one of the characters when, I guess, they were talking about Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And she was the person who actually listened to the thing about Nagasaki. Was she reading it or something? Or she had gone to a museum about it?
The other characters, Schiller and RJ, had visited both Hiroshima and Nagasaki and been to the atomic museums in both places. And in true museological fashion, compared the two museums and how the messages of both museums were quite different, and they are. I've been to both and was struck by the difference between the two, because one of them is more about the atrocity and the other one is much more about the politics. And the U.S. fares much less favorably in Nagasaki.
Well, yeah, and it was very heavy, you know, and that was something I hadn't even thought about, you know, in relation to that. And I'm not somebody who's disconnected from what goes on in the world and what has gone on in the world, and particularly in relation to Imperials and what it does around the world. But that particular moment, and then it was around there that the mother also made the statement about she's much happier overseas than she was when she was back in Oklahoma, the States. And she was much more sort of, to hell with you. I see what you've done, and I'm not going to take it anymore, in terms of speaking to the bigger powers.
She does take a stand, and it's a big part of her journey. She starts off the play very afraid. She doesn't want to go. She's afraid, you know, she won't sleep. She'll have insomnia. She doesn't want any discomfort, you know, doesn't want to be taken out of her rut. And she realizes that if she gets out of Oklahoma, this place that she complains about in a very comfortable fashion, if she's somewhere else, she might actually experience freedom and achieve a sense of bravery. And that is where she gets by the end of the play, not just politically, but with discoveries about herself and her own future. She becomes brave and a lot less afraid. And the situation, as the play progresses, becomes more and more dire, and yet she becomes less afraid. which is a really interesting contrast. In the final moments of the play, which I again won't disclose, but she's the brave one. And all the others are in a form of denial, and she is not.
Yeah. The question gets posed before people, and I think you had the mother answered this question, but are you willing to stand up? Are you willing to stand up and do something, or are you going to spend your life laying down in front of it all?
Or sitting passively in a theater seat.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to thank you very much for the play. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
The mutability of theater is important to me. It's portrayed so many different ways in this production. I think one of the things that speaks to the mutability theater is that without the script changing, this play seems like it was written this morning. And even since you saw the play a week ago, the play got more pertinent with the events of the last few days. And one of my fears is that the events of the world could get ahead of the play and the events of the play. Right now, the play is slightly ahead of where we are. But I love that the audience comes in and applies what they heard on television or the radio or read in a tweet that very day. They bring that in with them. And that happens in any play. But in this one, it works especially well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Tom, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Tom Jacobson, the author of Walking to Buchenwald. That was actually most of a longer conversation we had, and you can hear the whole interview by going to my Facebook page, where I'll post a link to the online audio. That wraps up our show for today, all right? I want to thank everybody that was involved in the show, Dr. Michael Mann, Jerry Lemke, and Tom Jacobson. I also want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and I want to thank my production assistant, Henry Carson, and my... Where is he? Where is Jeff Pryor? There he is. I want to thank Jeff Pryor, who's always standing by the show and helping out in ways that many people couldn't do, but he does, all right? So I'm also trying to get out of here real quick. So we're going to go out now with a little bit called from War Pigs by, actually it's by a Bhangra group. So check this out, and I'll talk to you again next week.